Hello, everyone. Why don't we get started? It's my distinct pleasure today, representing the National Institutes of Health, to welcome our featured Wednesday Walls speaker, Dr. Leonard Garante, to present his research. Dr. Garante was an undergraduate and got his undergraduate degree at MIT, and then he went off and did his PhD at Harvard with John Beckwith. After that, he stayed and did a postdoc with Mark Potashny. And since 1981, he's been a professor at MIT, where he's currently the Novartis Professor of Biology. He is one of the most recognized scientists in America and internationally for his work on aging. And his seminal work has shown that, like many other cellular processes in complex mammals, that aging appears to be a genetic phenomena, and that is the events that regulate the process of longevity or aging are, in fact, regulated by genes. And his work today will be involved, these seminal discoveries, and the title of his presentation today will be Sirtuinin Aging and Diseases.
Okay. Is this on? Can everybody hear me? Okay. Well, thank you very much for that introduction, and I'd like to thank Steve Zulo for organizing a really stimulating symposium today on mitochondria and diseases. So what I'm going to do in my lecture this afternoon is to talk about our work on sirtuins. And what I'm going to do is first give an introduction to tell you how we got into this field in the first place. Then I'm going to talk about a little bit about sirtuins and aging. But really the focus of the talk today will be what I think is the connection between sirtuins and the major diseases of aging. And I'll talk about several of those diseases as we move along. Okay, so I'll just operate this myself. So when we started working on aging almost 20 years ago now, the school of thought was that aging is not programmed because it occurs late in life. Okay, therefore, it escapes natural selection and has a haphazard, unprogrammed nature to it. And I think this is a rather compelling case, and one can't really dispute it. However, there were a few voices in the wilderness that said that at least under some circumstances, aging might be regulated. So it was known that there was a link between diet and aging. There was a diet called calorie restriction, obviously low in calories, which could make rodents live up to 50 to 100% longer than control ad libitum fed rodents. And it was also known at that time that there were mutations in single genes in C. elegans that could make the roundworm live significantly longer, each arguing that there must be some simple aspect about aging if you could extend the lifespan in this way. So we came into this as agnostics with regard to this dilemma and focused on a simple problem, and that is aging in budding yeast. And this was defined by cell division or budding, where aging is defined by how many times mother cells can divide before they reach senescence. And one can follow these cell divisions microscopically and simply count how many times cells have divided. And what was shown initially in the 1950s was that mother cells divide a relatively fixed number of times, about 20 or so, and at that point they senesce. And so we spent really the most of the decade of the 1990s looking for genes that could affect this aging process in yeast. And what we came to is a gene of particular interest, which was a gene called SIR2 in yeast. And this was functioning as an anti-aging gene. And that statement is really reflected here in these survival curves. And what we're looking at is survival of a normal wild-type strain with one copy of SIR2. And you can see that everybody's alive, and then there's a rather precipitous decline in viability of mother cells at about 20 generations. And this is characteristic of aging. There's a rapid decline in viability due to aging. And what you can see is if you delete the SIR2 gene here, the lifespan is short. And that's true of a reasonable number of genes in yeast. There are many ways you can create a short lifespan. But what was really interesting is that adding an extra copy of this gene extended the lifespan beyond the wild type, suggesting that SIR2 was limiting for lifespan in this system, and moreover, that the function of the gene was to slow or to retard aging. Now, we then looked at a different system, the roundworm, and in C. elegans, there are numerous differences in the aging process. First of all, the adult body of the worm consists entirely of non-dividing cells. So the soma is all post-mitotic in the worm, and the worms live about 2 to 3 weeks, and then they die. Basically, they stop moving on the petri plate, and you kind of poke them and prod them and cajole them, and when nothing works, you score them as dead. Okay, and in this system, what we wanted to do, because we were really keyed by what we had found in yeast, is to look for anti-aging genes. So we screened free duplications that would create an increase in gene dosage of genes that were present on the duplication. And we spanned across the whole genome to look for genes that could, when present on a duplication, extend the lifespan in this system. And we got a few hits. One stood out particularly. And when we whittled down the relevant gene on that duplication, incredibly, it was the ortholog of SIR2, which in C. elegans is now called SIR2.1. And you can see that data from Heidi Tissenbaum's study here. Wild-type worms have a lifespan shown here in black. And when you make a transgenic worm with an extra copy of SIR2.1, you extend the lifespan dramatically. So this was really interesting that the same gene could do this. And we knew something about what was happening with these yeast or worms when they aged. And we thought that what was causing aging was very different in the two cases, consistent with the idea that one is a replicative kind of aging and the other is post-mitotic cell aging. And so we were struck by the fact that even though the aging, the causes of aging were different, the same gene was governing the lifespan in the two systems. And that was really an important question, and it was at the same time a conundrum. Why would that be? Why would there be pervasive anti-aging gene? So yeast and C. elegans diverged about a billion years ago, and our findings suggested that this mechanism existed in the common ancestor of yeast and worms, and ought to exist in all progenitors, including mammals. And in fact, we think that is the case. The question still is why? Why is that? And to me, the critical insight that allowed me to understand what was going on here came from a study of the biochemistry of what these proteins actually do. So in this study, we had purified the yeast SIR2 protein and the mammalian ortholog, which is called SIR-T1. And you may hear the term sirtuins, and sirtuins refers collectively to all proteins in all systems with homology to SIR2. They're called sirtuins. And what we did with these purified proteins is we probed in a test tube what activity they might have. And what we stumbled into was rather remarkable. We found that there were protein deacetylases, that they could deacetylate lysines in substrate proteins. And that was not so incredible because deacetylases had been described at this time. But what was unique about sirtuins is that they absolutely required NAD every reaction cycle and, in fact, split NAD every cycle of deacetylation. So these are NA-dependent deacetylases, now called class 3 deacetylases. And to me, immediately, this suggested that sirtuins could be the connection that link aging and metabolism. And it made me think for the first time about this process of dietary restriction or calorie restriction and whether sirtuins might be relevant in this process. So the view at that time then was, yes, aging really is not programmed. It plays out. However, aging can be regulated. In particular, sirtuins may regulate aging in accord with metabolism and diet, and this may be adaptive. Now, the reason that this may be adaptive is if you can adjust life strategy, whether to reproduce or sooner or later, as a function of the environment, that's a winning strategy. So if the environment is harsh, if food is scarce, then it's better to delay reproduction, okay, and reproduce later should food become available. But that strategy is only going to work if you're young enough to reproduce later. So it makes sense that there would be a system that could recognize environment and regulate aging so that reproduction can be timed appropriately with a favorable environment. Okay, now, so the thinking was then sirtuins might be this interface between environment and aging. Now, it may even be broader than aging. Sirtuins may work more broadly than that, and there were two papers published this year that show that sirtuins can couple metabolism to something other than aging, and in particular the circadian clock that regulates circadian rhythm in mammalian cells was shown in two separate studies to be regulated by direct deacetylation by SIRT1 of components of the mammalian clock. So I think that the possibility that the biology of sirtuins is broader than just aging is really to be considered. So what does SIRT1 do in mammalian cells? Well, it has numerous proteins now that have been shown to be substrates that it can deacetylate. And this is a short list, and I'll just group them into a few categories for you. The first is metabolism, and I'll talk a little bit today about this protein called PGC1-alpha, which is a target of deacetylation by SIRT1, and there are other targets in the metabolic arena. There are targets that relate to cancer, and I'll talk a little bit about this in a moment. There are targets that relate to damage control and stress, and these might be important in neurodegenerative diseases, as I'll talk about in the later part of the talk. And there are targets, the transcription factor NF-kappa-B and RUNX2, that are involved in, again, numerous processes, NF-kappa-B in the immune system and inflammation, but also in bone development. And I'll talk about these targets at the end of the talk. So the question then is SIRT1 a good target for diseases of aging? Now, we know from studies over the past decade or so that in mouse models, calorie restriction itself is protective against numerous diseases of aging, including everything listed on this slide here. So if SIRT1 is an important mediator of calorie restriction, then one might think that SIRT1 would be a good target for diseases of aging. So I'm going to talk, the way I've organized the talk today, about metabolic diseases first, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, cancer. I'll just have a few words to say about these from the published literature. I want to talk about several unpublished studies in my lab on SIRT1 and neurodegenerative diseases, and finish with osteoporosis. Okay, so with regard to metabolic diseases, it was shown several years ago that an activator of SIRT1 could be protective against metabolic diseases. So there was a study from, first of all, David Sinclair's lab identified resveratrol in vitro as an activator of SIRT1. And what they were able to show is that resveratrol could increase the lifespan in numerous systems, yeast, flies, roundworms. And in more recently, in mice, they showed that resveratrol could protect against the deleterious metabolic effects of a high-fat, high-caloric diet. And that was shown also in Johann Alwitz's lab, and I'll show you some data from his lab in a moment. And they showed that this protection worked largely via this target, PGC1-alpha, which had been demonstrated by Rogers et al. To be a substrate of SIRT1 deacetylation. Now, more recently, Sirtris, the biotech company, has shown that new categories of SIRT1 activators exist that are much more potent than resveratrol, and these have similar anti-diabetic effects in rodents. So I'll show you one example of this from Johann Alwitz. So these are two mice. Without and with resveratrol. What happens to these mice is they're trying to keep up on the treadmill, And if they fall back, they're given a little shock that prods them along. The resveratrol mouse does better. And in fact, they report in this study many tests of fitness that show that the resveratrol-fed mice are leaner, fitter, and live longer, actually, than the control mice. Now, more recently, that is to say this year, there were two papers in which the activity of SIRT1 was increased not by a drug, and there's been some question whether resveratrol really works through SIRT1 or through some other target. And the fact that structurally distinct chemical entities that I just told you about can give the same effect in mice is one argument that SIRT1 is the target, because what these chemicals have in common is that they activate SIRT1 in vitro. The second argument is that one can increase SIRT1 activity genetically by a transgene, and the finding is that SIRT1 transgenic overexpressing mice essentially behave like these activator dose mice. They're protected against high fat or aging-induced diabetes, and there are two studies in 2008 recently that show this. And I think it's particularly interesting to see that SIRT1 transgenes can protect against aging-induced diabetes, because that's a direct demonstration, I think, that SIRT1 in mammals has an anti-aging activity. Okay. Now, we also generated a mouse, a transgenic mouse in my lab that we described in a paper in 07, and I'll just mention that briefly here because I'm going to come back to it later in the talk. But again, its phenotype is consistent with what I've been telling you. It has low fat, it's highly insulin sensitive and glucose tolerant. It shows better performance than controlled on rotarod, and also showed delayed mating, again, showing that there really may be a connection in this pathway between physical fitness and longevity, if you will, and reproduction. And here's an example of the degree of overexpression of the protein in this mouse, which is shown here. SIRT2D is the transgenic compared to the control. And I'm showing you regions of the brain because this will become relevant later when I show you our attempts to cross this mouse into neurodegenerative disease models. Okay, so let me close this introductory part then with a summary of numerous papers recently published that link calorie restriction to sirtuins, and in particular, since today was a day of a mitochondrial symposium here earlier, what this highlights is that in many of these systems, what one observes is the calorie restriction triggers an increase in mitochondria. There's an increase in the actual number of or activity of mitochondria. So in yeast, we found in O2 that calorie restriction upregulates mitochondrial activity, which increases the activity of the yeast SIRT2. And the reason this happens is because the increase in mitochondria more rapidly converts NADH into NAD by electron transport. And NAD is activating for SIRT1, and NADH is a competitive inhibitor. So that is what gives rise to the activation of SIRT2 and the increase in lifespan. In mammals, there's pretty clear data from numerous studies now that calorie restriction triggers an increase in SIRT1 and also endothelial nitric oxide synthase in mice. This results in the deacetylation of PGC1-alpha, which was shown by Rogers et al. To be activating. And what PGC1-alpha does is it activates genes encoding mitochondrial proteins in the nucleus. So mitochondrial biogenesis is triggered, which may, in fact, influence other SIRTs. There are 7 mammalian SIRTuins in all. These three here, in particular, SIRT3, 4, and 5, are proteins that target to the mitochondria. So this really highlights this link, this close relationship between SIRTuins and mitochondria. Three of the proteins are mitochondrial proteins. A fourth, SIRT1, regulates mitochondrial biogenesis, and the net effect is an increase in lifespan. There's even been a study in humans, and this is quite a feat because, generally speaking, it's very difficult to get human data in calorie restriction studies. And the reason is people cheat because many of these studies in the past have failed. The Pennington Group has been able to somehow coax people to stay on this diet for 6 months. And what they found in muscle punch biopsies is an increase in SIRT1 protein and an increase in mitochondria. So I think that these features are very pervasive. Now, you might note that one thing that's a little bit different here is in yeast, SIRT2 is downstream of the increase in mitochondria, and here SIRT1 is upstream of the increase in mitochondria. Now, I'm going to close this section with just an idea to try to pull this together. Why might there be an increase in mitochondria? And why is it a good thing to increase mitochondria? And I think it's helpful to first think on the aging side, where one can think of aging as creating damage that's not exclusively mitochondrial, but centered on mitochondria due to ROS production, mutations in the DNA, and so on. And this leads to low mitochondrial function and a reduction in oxidative phosphorylation. Now, if there's a reduction in the ability of electrons to enter the ETC, then NADH will build up. And if NADH builds up and the cell is reductive, that'll tend to reduce sirtuin activity across the board because NADH inhibits sirtuins and NAD activates sirtuins, and that would be consonant with an aging phenotype. Conversely, calorie restriction, by triggering an increase in SIRT1 and mitochondrial biogenesis, would tend to lower NADH. So that would be one effect in the direction of lowering NADH. Also, if the fuel source, if the energy source is low coming into the system, then the activity of the TCA cycle will be lowered, and the conversion of glucose into NADH by the TCA cycle will be lowered. So NADH production will be reduced, and any NADH that gets made will be scarfed up by the electron transport chain, both of which will give low NADH, high SIRT1 activity, and slow aging. So at a minimum, this is a way to think about this, a framework. Okay, now what about cancer? Let me say a few words here, and I call cancer the razor's edge. And the reason is SIRT1, SIRT2ins are survival factors. So for neurons, for cardiac cells, survival is a good thing. Okay, if you have a pro-survival factor, that will engender longevity. However, for cancer cells, survival is a bad thing. So this raised the question at the outset, how would SIRT1 play out with respect to cancer? And there have been numerous claims that, in fact, SIRT1 might be pro-cancer, might be oncogenic. Counterintuitive, though, that may be. Interestingly, there have been several papers, again this year, which come down on the opposite side and say SIRT1 can function as a tumor suppressor. So some of the papers come from here, and from Dr. Deng, and one from Dr. Deng's lab, and another Dr. Deng's lab in collaboration with Torin Finkel's lab. And some of this work was discussed this morning at the symposium, but these are striking findings. In one paper, for example, what was shown in this study, among other things, was that if one looks at the tumorigenesis in P53 knockout mice, if you simply reduce the dosage of SIRT1 from plus plus to plus minus in heterozygotes, you exacerbate the tumor phenotype in the P53 knockout mice. So SIRT1 is protective in this system. In this other study, there's a very interesting story that links the BRCA1 gene, which is involved in tumor protection for breast cancer, and shows that in the absence of BRCA1, there's low levels of SIRT1 in cells, and this low level of SIRT1 results in high levels of a protein called survivin, which is associated with tumorigenesis, raising a model where SIRT1 is protective in breast cancer, and in fact may be part of the way BRCA1 protects. Now, the third study, I'll just mention, I'll show one data slide. This was a study we did in collaboration with David Sinclair, and it was to look at colon cancer in mice, which is very, very closely associated with this Wnt signaling pathway, and in fact, mutations in this pathway in the APC gene can predispose to colon cancer in humans and in the mouse model, I'll show you. And the reason for that is these mutations in APC stabilize beta-catenin in the cytoplasm It goes to the nucleus. It turns on pro-growth genes for cell cycling and for growth, and that drives colon cancer. So the model that we used was a heterozygous mouse for APC-MIN, and this mouse develops tumors. You can see shown here in the duodenum and the ileum, these lumps are tumors. And then the experiment was to overexpress SIRT1 in the guts of these animals and to look for protection. And you can actually see it visually here. You can see that there are fewer lumps in those animals, and the quantitation is shown here. It's actually a striking suppression of tumors in this model by overexpressing SIRT1 about 2 to 3-fold in the gut. And we suggest in this paper that the mechanism of this repression might be that SIRT1 can directly target beta-catenin. And I'll just show one piece of data that makes us think that. So this is a cell line in which beta-catenin has been stabilized and can go to the nucleus. And you can see beta-catenin in the nucleus of these cells. These are colon cancer cells. And if you knock down SIRT1 with RNAi in these cells, you get an increase in nuclear staining of beta-catenin. And if you overexpress SIRT1, much like we did in the guts of those mice, you essentially see a cleansing of the nucleus. And we think beta-catenin is evicted from the nucleus under these conditions. So the take-home lesson, then, is that at least in some tumors, maybe many tumors, SIRT1 can be protective by targeting a particular pathway that is driving the tumor phenotype in that particular cancer. Okay, now I'm going to turn to the third topic, neurodegenerative diseases, and this will all be unpublished data from my lab. And the first study is a relatively new study in the lab on Alzheimer's disease that's being carried out by a postdoc, Guizem Donmez, in the lab. So I'll just remind you that Alzheimer's is characterized by plaques of the A-beta peptide in the brain, and these amyloid beta plaques accumulate from a precursor protein called APP. And APP is a protein that's synthesized, finds the plasma membrane, and then has two possible processing pathways. It can be processed by the alpha secretase, which is benign, which does not generate any A-beta, or it can be processed by the beta secretase, which leads to a subsequent cleavage by the gamma secretase and the generation of A-beta 1 to 40 and 1 to 42, these peptides that form plaques. Now, the connection between this beta-gamma processing pathway and the disease is very clear from examples of familial AD in which mutations, either in APP here or in presenilin 1 or presenilin 2, which are components of the gamma secretase, these mutations can predispose to Alzheimer's disease. The APP mutation favoring cleavage down this pathway, and presenilin mutations as gain of function, again favoring generation of the A-beta amyloid peptides. Okay, so the model then that we got into the lab is shown here, and it's a double transgenic mouse which has both a transgene with the APP Swedish mutation and the presenilin 1 mutation, both of which favor production of A-beta. And you can see in these mice at about 3 months of age, you start to see plaques, A-beta plaques. And these are sections of the cortex of the brain. And by 13 months of age, the plaques are very, very large and abundant. So what we did then, the strategy is to say, okay, what happens in this model if we vary the dosage of SIRT1? And in this experiment shown here, we used the transgenic mouse that I showed you earlier that overexpresses SIRT1 in the brain, and I showed you that data that it does so. And we simply, in 5-month-old mice, counted plaques. And we grouped the plaques as small, medium, large. This is the control AD mice shown here. And these are the AD mice with SIRT1 overexpression. There's a pretty large reduction in the plaque burden in these animals. We also used heterozygous SIRT1 mice to try to lower the levels of SIRT1. And this the effect in these animals is really not statistically different or significant compared to wild type. What about pathology? We looked at inflammation in the brain by staining for gliosis using a marker called GFAP. And that an example of that is shown here in the AD model at 3 months of age. You can begin to see signs of gliosis, GFAP staining. And in 13-month-old mice, the staining becomes very, very prominent. So again, we looked at AD mice, shown here, quantitated GFAP staining or gliosis. And the transgenic mice, again, are highly protected against the gliosis. And again, the heterozygous mice with 50% as much SIRT1 really don't show a statistically significant difference from the wild type. So these results were interesting in that we were seeing protection with the transgenic mouse that overexpressed. However, we were disappointed that we didn't see any effect of the heterozygous mouse. So what we did is we went to a different strategy to lower SIRT1 in these mice. And we couldn't simply knock out SIRT1 in the whole animal because the whole body SIRT1 knockout is lethal. It's a homozygous lethal. So we went to a tissue-specific knockout strategy. And the strategy, and these are studies, these mice were generated by Dina Cohen and Agnieszka Czopek, two postdocs in the lab. And they use mice that were first described from Fred Alt's lab about 5 years ago. And in these mice, exon 4 of the SIRT1 gene, which is a catalytic domain of the enzyme, is flanked by LOXP sites. We took these mice from Fred and spent a couple of years back-crossing them into C57 Black 6 so that they would be compatible for crossing with a whole variety of mice that can express the Cre recombinase under tissue-specific promoters. And the one I'll tell you about here is a brain-specific promoter, Nestin, which drives Cre expression in all neural progenitor cells and expresses early at embryonic day 11.5. So these knockout mice, then, one can look at SIRT1 in the brains, and you don't see an absence of the protein because all you've done is deleted one of the exons. You can see a reduction in molecular weight. That's shown here in the cerebellum cortex. Striatum doesn't show so clearly here, but this is not a pan-brain knockout, and it's functionally SIRT1 negative in the brain. So what happens, then, when you cross these with the AD model? What actually happened was very dramatic. The mice die. So the mice that have the brain-specific knockout by themselves are perfectly viable. The AD model itself is perfectly viable. But the combination of the AD with the brain-specific knockout of SIRT1, the mice really don't make it to 4 months of age. Now, we know that these other mice live at least a year, and the AD mice reportedly live 2 years. We're not sure how long the brain-specific knockouts by themselves will live yet. But there's this rather strong synthetic lethality of depleting SIRT1 in the brain and challenging with the AD transgene in this mice. Again, consistent with the idea that there's a really important interaction between SIRT1 and this disease model in the brain. So you might ask, well, is there an increase in A-beta staining and gliosis in the mice that have the brain knockout? Now we have to look at young animals because they don't live very long. So these are 3-month-old. And the AD by themselves at 3 months show just beginning to show A-beta plaques. And in the AD mice with the knockout of SIRT1 in the brain, there's a considerable exacerbation in the plaque burden in these animals. So what these findings tell us, then, is that there really is a connection, we think, between SIRT1 and AD in this model. SIRT1 is protective. And the biology is there, and the challenge now is to work out the mechanism of how SIRT1 is protecting. And, of course, whether it means that small molecules that can activate SIRT1 will be protective as well. Now, we can rule out trivial models, and that is to say we know expression of the transgenes themselves, APP and also the presenilin-1 transgene are not affected. So this is the APP. Transgene in the AD mouse or the AD mouse with the brain-specific knockout. You can see the protein levels are the same. And the same is true for mice in which SIRT1 is overexpressed here versus mice with AD alone. So these effects are not operating at the level of expression of these genes, and we think it's either the processing of APP, the tendency of the A-beta to aggregate, or the effects of A-beta aggregates on neurons in the brain. And we hope to be able to tease that out. The second disease that we've looked at, where we've actually been working on considerably longer, so we have more data, is Huntington's disease. This is an autosomal dominant neurodegenerative disease caused by a CAG triplet repeat expansion within the human Huntington's gene. It preferentially affects neurons of the striatum, which is a subcortical region that's also highly metabolically active. These neurons atrophy in this disease. The symptoms appear in middle age, include chorea, which are uncontrolled movements, psychiatric disturbances, weight loss. Disease is always fatal. There's no treatment or cure. It's bad disease. Now, there are several models for Huntington's disease. This is there's a very good infrastructure out there for studying this disease. And the model that we chose is called R6-2. Now, this is the most severe of the models that's out there. And the reason I wanted to choose it is that it plays out very fast. So these mice live about 3 months before they succumb to the disease. And so we could do experiments on a rapid basis. So what is this model? It's a transgenic mouse expressing the exon 1 of the human Huntington protein, having a vastly expanded number of CAG repeats encoding glutamines. It displays Huntington aggregates in the brain, like the human disease. It preferentially affects the neurons of the striatum, like the human disease. And it's in the literature that at least a milder model, not R6-2, but a milder HD model can be mitigated by calorie restriction. So there was sort of an intellectual basis for asking the question whether SIRT1 might affect this disease. And here the endpoint is survival on these mice. So I told you they live about 3 or 4 months. And these are the HD mice shown here, the R6-2s. And when SIRT1 is overexpressed in the brains using the same transgenic mouse I told you about earlier, there's a very nice rescue in these mice. Now, this is... there's been a lot done with these R6-2 mice, and this is among the best rescue that's been reported for survival in this R6-2 severe mouse background. So we're very excited about this effect. Again, I should say that this is a study led by Dina Cohen, a postdoc in the lab, and we're collaborating in this study with Dimitri Crank's lab at MGH. Again, trivial possibility is we're affecting expression of the disease gene. So this is a Western blot with two different antibodies for Huntington's protein in the R6-2 mice shown here, or the R6-2 mice with the SIRT1 transgene. And clearly, there's no reduction in expression of Huntington's by this transgene, so the effect is not trivial. We then looked at the brains of the animals. So what happens, again, in the R6-2, this is the striatum here, and it contracts because all the neurons are getting smaller, and it exposes a cavity or ventricle when that happens. And so we looked at this in the R6-2 with the transgene, and we can see a nice suppression of this neuronal atrophy in the mice. So the mice not only are surviving longer, but we're seeing a suppression of the pathology in the brain in these animals. Now, what could be the mechanism? And there's a fairly long list of candidates for how this could be working. And they could all be true. But I'm going to focus on one of them today because I think it's rather interesting. And this involves a protein. Those of you who were here for Mark Mattson's talk heard about this about an hour ago, called BDNF, which stands for brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And this is a factor that promotes neuronal survival but also synapse formation and neurogenesis in the brain. The levels decrease with aging and can be increased by calorie restriction. So that right away would draw our attention to this as an interesting molecule. In particular, it's linked to Huntington's disease. It's a survival signal for the striatum that is made and emanates from the cortex and moves to the striatum. And the important thing, there are two important facts. First is that the activity of BDNF is disrupted in Huntington's disease. And that occurs at several levels, but I'll show you the transcription itself, the BDNF gene, is reduced in Huntington's disease. And furthermore, deletion of BDNF from the cortex in mice can mimic Huntington's disease. So the depletion of BDNF is sufficient to trigger this kind of neuronal pathology in the striatum in mouse brains. Now, the reason we got interested in this is shown here. So these are levels of This is wrong. And wild-type mice shown here. This should be wild-type. This should be R6-2 alone, shown here. And this is the reduction that's been described in the literature. I just made this slide, so of course it's not right. Between wild-type levels of BDNF and levels of BDNF in an R6-2 mouse. Now, this transgene, this should be here. So this is the R6-2. Just ignore this. Just don't look at this. Just listen to my words. Wild-type, R6-2. R6-2 with the SIRT1 transgene. There's almost a complete rescue in BDNF. BDNF levels in that mouse are approximately that of wild-type. And the only one that's right is this one, which is a wild-type mouse with the transgene, where the levels of BDNF actually overshoot that of a wild-type mouse. So that was interesting and suggested that this could be the explanation for the rescue in these mice. What about knocking out SIRT1? All I've told you about is overexpression. So we've now generated the mice where we have a brain-specific SIRT1 knockout in combination with R6-2. And I'll tell you two things about that. First of all, knocking out SIRT1 exacerbates the R6-2 phenotype. And you can see that here by a behavioral test of rotor rod performance, week 10 and week 14. Here are the R6-2 mice here. And here are the R6-2 mice with SIRT1 knocked out in the brain. Here's week 14, R6-2, SIRT1 knocked out. There clearly is a synthetic effect. As we saw with the lethality in the AD, there's a synthetic effect between deleting SIRT1 in the brain and the R6-2 disease gene. But here's the other thing about these mice. So just the knockout alone, no R6-2. If you ask what are the levels of BDNF mRNA in the brain of wild type versus SIRT1 knockout, they're roughly half in the just knocking out SIRT1 in the brain. So this really makes us think that SIRT1 will turn out to be a direct regulator of BDNF expression in the brain. And therefore, that connection is intriguing from the point of view of neurodegenerative diseases and makes us think that this connection could explain the neuroprotection observed in the Huntington's disease model. Now, the other thing I told you about BDNF when I introduced it is not only is it a survival factor for neurons, but it also promotes neurogenesis. So that sort of takes us into a new realm. And we've begun to look at this realm, and this is the realm of behavior, learning, and memory. So what I'll show you is a study where the data I'll show you is clear, but the interpretation is not so clear. So take this as an interesting preliminary finding. So we've set up a study, and this is Serge Liebert in my lab with some help from Li Wei-Sai's lab. We set up a test for spatial learning and memory called the Morris Water Maze. And we've actually done other tests as well now. I'll tell you about this one. And what you do in this test is you ask how well can a mouse remember? And you do it by dropping a mouse into a pool of water, which is opaque. And mice can swim very well, and they will swim, but they don't like it. And if they can find a platform, they will. And what you do is you submerge a platform so they can't see it here. So they'll eventually stumble into it. And the next time they go in, okay, they'll find the platform a little bit sooner, and so on and so forth. And that's the test. So what I'm going to show you now is after 6 days of training, and I'll show you the table, but these are typical mice, of wild-type mice, and mice, no disease gene now, but with a brain-specific knockout of SIRT1. Let's see if I can make this work. Okay, here's the wild type. It's been trained. That's pretty good, right? Okay, here's the knockout. Gets worse. Even when it comes close. And here's the data. So this is the learning. This is the time it takes to find the platform with training in a wild type, and that time is reduced. The mouse is learning and remembering, and the knockout is grossly defective in this activity. So that's true. The other thing we know now about these mice is that there's a defect in neurogenesis in the brain-specific knockout. And I'll show you, again, one piece of data along these lines. So this is a stain for newly made neurons in the dentate gyri of the hippocampus of these mice. This stain is staining these cells in red. So these are newly made neurons in a wild-type mouse, shown here, and in the brain-specific knockout mouse, shown there. And I think it's evident that there's a reduction. And one can also do this by staining with BRDU and arrive at similar conclusions. So to close this part of the talk, then, on neurodegeneration, SIRT1 overexpression in the brain rescues AD and HD models. SIRT1 depletion exacerbates these models. SIRT1 regulates BDNF. We think there's a possible role of BDNF in the rescue of HD. And SIRT1, and again, this is new, so I would take this with a grain of salt, may influence learning and memory via effects on neurogenesis. Now, the reason that would be exciting is that that sort of would bring us to a new level beyond diseases, and we could start to think about the known effects of aging on cognition, and think that maybe that will fall under this rubric as well. And ultimate drugs that come out of this work might have benefit, not only for frank diseases, but just for the normal depression of cognition that occurs in everybody with aging. Okay, the last bit, last few minutes, let me talk about osteoporosis. We're interested in this disease because this is, again, a really, really a canonical disease of aging. And in fact, everybody will experience bone loss in the last half of life, and if it falls below a threshold, gives rise to established osteoporosis. So here's an example of the soft inner part of bone called trabecular bone, normal, and you can see the thinning in osteoporosis. Now, there are two types of osteoporosis. Type 1 causes an increase in cells called osteoclasts that are involved in bone resorption. So these are cells that eat up bone, okay? And type 2 is due to a decrease in osteoblasts, which are cells that make bone. And our bones are constantly being remodeled by these two cell types. And that remodeling is very, very important to cope with micro fractures in brain, in bone, that occur over time. So what we wanted to know then is, does SIRT1 play any role in these critical cell types for bone? And so we took an approach, again, of knocking out SIRT1 in a tissue-specific way. And this is a study of a graduate student, Kayvon Zainabadi, and it's in collaboration with Greg Mundy's lab at Vanderbilt Medical Center. So what we did then was knock out SIRT1 in osteoclasts. And to do that, we used, and this is, it's useful to look at this. This is the development of osteoclasts starting from a monocytic lineage. And the promoter we used that drove Cre expression is lysozyme M, which is expressed here in this differentiation pathway. And I'll also point out that along here in the middle of the pathway, the transcription factor NF-kappa-B and an extracellular factor called RANK ligand are critical in determining differentiation of osteoclasts. So again, the strategy was very simple. It was to take the conditional floxed allele of SIRT1, cross it with mice expressing Cre from the lysozyme M promoter, and knock out SIRT1 in the osteoclast. which is what we did. And unlike the whole body knockout mice, these mice are normal. They look normal. They're normal in most ways you can measure, except one, and that is bone density. So when you do a bone scan, you can see that there's diminished bone density as early as 1 month. That's shown by a kind of scanning called micro-CT scanning. Here you can see the reduction, I think, in density, which is charted there. So these mice are osteoporotic. You can also look at this ex vivo. That's what I'll show you in the next slide when it decides to come up. It's always a lag before this slide comes up. And in this experiment here, what we've done is we've taken cells ex vivo, bone marrow cells, and we've differentiated them in vitro to form osteoclasts, which we can stain for a factor called TRAP. And these red cells are osteoclasts here. We drive differentiation by application of MCSF and increasing amounts of RANK ligand, this factor I told you about a minute ago. And we obtain the cells either from wild type or knockout. And what you can see is that there's a very, very big increase in differentiation of osteoclasts in the knockout. And this increase is reflected both in an increase in number and also the size. So osteoclasts tend to be multinucleated cells, much like macrophages, which also come from this lineage. And in the knockout, the cells are monstrous and many. Now, what I won't show you the data for is that this difference between the knockout and the wild type can be rescued by adding a selective inhibitor of NF-kappa-B. So our current thinking about this is that knocking out SIRT1 drives differentiation of osteoclasts because there's too much NF-kappa-B activity in these cells. And it leads us to a picture for osteoclasts then. That looks like this under normal conditions. So in SIRT1 wild-type mice, perhaps in young people, SIRT1 is keeping osteoclast differentiation under control by deacetylating and repressing the activity of NF-kappa-B and keeping osteoclast genes regulated. But when SIRT1 is knocked out, what happens is NF-kappa-B activity goes up. That drives expression of osteoclast genes differentiation, and the mouse has too many osteoclasts. And it's interesting to think that this might be, we don't know this, but this might be an element of what happens in type 1 osteoporosis. And it leads us to think T1 might be important then in age-related bone loss. Now, the other relevant subtype, cell type for bone is osteoblasts, and we've also knocked out SIRT1 in these cells. These are the bone synthesizing cells. And this is the promoter that drives Cre in these particular mice. And here's the data. Again, knockout versus control. No gross effect. Grossly speaking, the mice are normal, but careful examination of bone density. At 1 month, actually, there was no difference in these mice, but over time, they become osteoporotic. And again, an ex vivo study from these mice has been revealing. And what we did in this study is to take cells now from the SIRT1 conditional flox mouse and differentiate them into osteoblasts in vitro. And the strategy here is to either infect these cells with a control virus or with a virus that will express Cre to delete SIRT1 ex vivo and to ask what happens. And here's the data here. When you knock out SIRT1, in these cells, you see a decrease in differentiated osteoblasts in this system. And lastly, with this, again, ex vivo approach, we were able to look at transcription of specific osteoblast genes. And what we found is that there's a systematic decrease in genes that are under control of a transcription factor, RUNX2, in osteoblasts. Whereas RUNX2 normally will drive differentiation of osteoblasts and expression of genes like osteocalcin, we see a defect. If we Cre delete SIRT1 in these cells ex vivo, there's a defect in targets of RUNX2 and in differentiation. So the model then that we have at this point is that for osteoblasts, SIRT1 is a positive regulator of differentiation, which acts via as a co-activator for RUNX2. Okay, so I will finish so there's time for questions. And so what I've told you is SIRT1 appears to impact diseases of aging, apparently by different mechanisms, these metabolic diseases, cancer, neurodegenerative diseases, osteoporosis. We see different SIRT1 targets, mechanisms, and it makes one ask, what is the common thread? And the common thread, I would argue, for all these diseases is aging. And by manipulating SIRT1, the hope is that we can have drugs that can keep this aging risk factor tamped down and exert benefit, therefore, broadly for all these diseases of aging. So let me just mention the people who did the experiments I told you about, Dina Cohen, Keyvan Zainabadi, Gizem Donmez, and Sergey Liebert in the lab. We've had many excellent collaborators without whom we couldn't have done these studies, alumni all over the place, and I want to thank these agencies for support and be happy to take questions.
So, Lenny, you told us a number of cases where overexpressing SIRT2 is protective in these disease situations. Have you seen any adverse effects of SIRT2-1 expression in, you know, healthy animals?
Well, in I think maybe the transgenic mice are instructive to address that question. So the one thing I mentioned that you know, could be considered adverse, certainly in terms of evolution, is reproduction is late and reduced in the transgenic mice. They clearly don't mate as well as the control, okay? The other thing I can tell you about those mice, the transgenic mice, is we're starting to get survival data now, and they don't live longer. So whatever it is that's killing that strain of mice, and very likely it's lymphoma, is probably not affected by SIRT1. However, the mice are much healthier. They don't show late-onset diabetes like control mice. And my sense is that if one could factor out the cancer problem that's affecting that particular strain of mice, they would live longer. But we don't see that. Now, there are two other strategies that I mentioned that other labs have used to make SIRT1 transgenic mice. So it's possible that they'll get different results with regard to survival. We'll have to wait and see.
So my question was going along the same line for the evolutionary aspects. In yeast, it seems that the reproductive output is bigger if you overexpress SIRT2. So why has evolution not selected such a strategy?
Again, so in yeast, what I showed you was adding one extra copy of SIRT2. If you add, if you express SIRT2 on a multi-copy plasmid in yeast, it's actually deleterious. So clearly there's an optimum for expression. But again, like calorie restriction itself, I think that the answer why, you know, this just isn't on all the time is because of effects on reproduction. So it's not adaptive. The most adaptive strategy is to have it be conditional with environment.
Since several laboratory reported 31 deactivated P3C3 and activated P3C3, so I wonder in your transgenic overexpressed 31 model, whether you have looked at P3C3 activity?
We haven't directly done that, no. But I mean, I think the data that 31 deacetylates P53 is clear. It's very, very strong, and that deacetylation affects the activity, and it's not a major effect. It's not like eliminating P53, but there's a modest downregulation of activity. I think that's all pretty clear.
But if that's the case, based on that model, maybe from the long term, in an overexpress of 31 may eventually result in tumor formation. But in your case, how long you follow your mice, whether they have any sign?
There were no overt signs. I mean, we haven't autopsied carefully these mice, but there's certainly no, you know, tumor masses that were observed in the transgenic mice.
So a related question is, the prediction is that if you had to cross your 31 knockout with the P53 knockout, you should not exacerbate tumorigenesis that you already have in P53 knockout if they are on the same pathway.
So remember, the SIRT1 knockout is lethal. The homozygous knockout is lethal.
Well, but you can remove SIRT1 in specific organs.
Yeah, and I should add, actually, one of the ideas why the SIRT1 knockout was lethal was because of unrestrained P53 activity in that mouse, in which case it should be rescued by crossing with a P53 knockout, right? But it's not. It's not. So it's lethal because SIRT1 is doing a lot of things, not just because of P53. But the experiment that was reported here showed that just reducing SIRT1 50% exacerbated the tumor phenotype in P53 knockout mice, and that data was very clear. Cancer Cell paper.
Have you had a chance to do overexpression and see its effect on the wild type in the water maze, in the Morris water maze test?
No, we haven't done that yet. These are new experiments. That's something we definitely want to do, to see if they're smarter. I think we also want to look more specifically at processes like long-term potentiation and see if we can, how precisely we can pinpoint molecular changes that are occurring in the brains as a function of SIRT1 dosage. But at the moment, for the transgenic overexpressor, the only data we have is with the disease models.
And presumably, this is all working through acetylation. And in how many cases have you been able to identify the protein that's being acetylated?
Well, I showed you a short list, and I would say the number of targets that have been identified in the literature, now maybe somebody here could give a better estimate than I can, but I would say it's more than 10, between 10 and 100.
It's been shown that autophagy is protective from developing Huntington's disease and Alzheimer's. And in turn, Finkel's lab, they've demonstrated that SIRT1 can promote autophagy. In your SIRT1 brain studies, have you looked at that?
We did a little bit. So as I said at the time, there's a list of things you could imagine that could account for the protection in the SIRT1 transgenic mice. And they may all be true. They may all be going on. But we, at the moment, we don't have any positive data that shows that the effect we're seeing is due to an increase in autophagy in the transgenic mice. It's possible, but we don't have data. The data that we do have is what I presented on BDNF.
You showed that SIRT1 can be a tumor suppressor in some of the tissue. How about, do you check some SIRT1 expression level in brain tumor tissue? They have difference?
In brain tumor tissue?
Yeah, brain tumor tissue.
I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure. Or what are you thinking?
Probably, but I don't know.
That levels might be low in gliomas? Someone might know the answer to that.
It's lower.
It's lower in gliomas, yeah. So there's your answer.
Oh. Yes, thank you for this wonderful presentation. I would like to know if you have looked at the expression level of SIRT1 and the telomerase activity or telomerase length. Is there any correlation between...
I don't think there's any good data that would connect SIRT1 to telomeres, but there is a paper that was published this year that shows that SIRT6, which I didn't talk about at all, is present at telomeres in human cells, deacetylates histone H3 at telomeres, and is involved in recruiting important proteins for telomere maintenance. The telomeres, a paper by Katrin Chua. So you should check that. So it's possible that function has been segregated to SIRT6.
And also another question, in human diseases, is there any correlation between the expression of SIRT1 and the diseases like in Alzheimer's disease or cancer. Have you checked in humans?
Again, we don't know. So the problem is, even for aging, I mean, the question I get asked all the time is, does SIRT1 go down with aging? And it's a more difficult question to answer than you might think. So you can do Western blots and look at the protein levels, but that's not really telling you about the activity. To know the activity, you really have to know the functional targets and quantitate them, either in aging or in disease models. And at the moment, the data is very fragmentary. But there certainly are examples where SIRT1 is affected in diseases. You just heard about one of them. And we have a little bit of data in mice for at least certain tissues where you can demonstrate a reduction over time with aging and activity. But there's, right now, I think there's not a systematic picture. For example, this would be really important in thinking about osteoporosis. So is what's happening over time in osteoblasts and osteoclasts at all due to a reduction in SIRT1 activity? And if so, could you rescue that with an appropriate chemical agonist?
For the bone differentiation model, what relationship between SIRT1 and LUNX2 there?
Well, we don't know yet. So what we're trying to do now is to see if SIRT1 deacetylates RUNX2. So first, is RUNX2 an acetylated protein? Does SIRT1 deacetylate? If it did, then the idea would be that it's the relationship, for example, SIRT1 deacetylates PGC1-alpha, it deacetylates the nuclear receptor LXR, and it activates them by deacetylating them. So that would be the simplest model.
So you already checked the SIRT1 deacetylate LUNX2?
No, as I said, we're trying to demonstrate determine whether RUNX2 is acetylated, and if so, if SIRT1 is the relevant deacetylase.